Welcome everyone to another edition of Overcoming Long COVID and CFS. Today, I guess it's actually this evening, I'm just so excited to have an old friend of mine, Dr. Matt Cook of BioReset in Campbell, California, who's joining us. And Dr. Cook has been someone we've shared a lot with over the years, and we learn a lot from each other. It's really a pleasure to share patients and ideas with the good Dr. Cook. And when it comes to long COVID, he's got some really, I think, interesting ideas that that we haven't explored much in the rest of the series. So Dr. Cook, Matt, good to have you. But first, give people a little idea of like your background and what you've been doing the last 15 years.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, and I'm delighted to be here. And as I was trying to work my way through the day, I just like many days, I had just a very unusual thing show up, and I sat and I said, "Oh my goodness, what?" Could possibly be going on in this unusual thing that I've never seen before. And I thought about it for 3 seconds and I said, "Oh, I know, I'm talking to Eric Gordon this afternoon. I'm gonna ask him." And so thank you for being you and being so helpful to my education and thought process over the years. And I needed it because I, after medical school, I did a residency in anesthesiology. And then my job, basically, I worked in surgery centers and was a medical director for surgery centers, and I would do ultrasound guided nerve blocks to put nerves to sleep so that we could do surgery with sedation, with ketamine. And so then that was fundamentally my life. And I did that until I found out about 12 years ago that you could start putting other things around nerves, sometimes dextrose, and other products that basically expanded into what is now we think of as regenerative medicine. And because we do in anesthesia, I had a lot of experience doing IV therapy. We began to combine that with IV therapy, functional medicine, and have been trying to build this sort of synergy between functional and integrative medicine and then a lot of the interventional procedures that can be done to help people.
Yeah, and that's been a wonderful combination. You know, I think many of us in this field have had exciting ideas of where we'd like to put things, but you're able to do it for us. So we really appreciate that, because that is the secret, is, knowing where you are with the needle and the ultrasound and that ability to put those two things together with what's really, really been exciting and where I think our sharing has been so helpful in thinking about what's going on with these folks, because, you know, over the years you've been including a lot more chronic complex illness in what mm-hmm. you do, and sharing that experience. And that's why we're talking today, because as we've discussed for our patients, is COVID, long COVID is another chronic complex illness. Inflammation is hanging around, and though there's a lot of similarities to chronic fatigue, it's got a different flavor on a lot of levels, you know? And that's why it's so important to be exploring it. So how are you approaching the long haul patient? I don't know what to call people with I think, don't like that expression really, but what do you?
That's a good one. I'm not sure that I like that title either, although I guess if people like using it then that's okay. It's such a good one, and I'm actually grateful that right from the very beginning, we probably took care of 1/3 functional medicine, 1/3 athletes, and 1/3 complex illness. And interestingly, each one of those categories kind of helps us contextualize and understand the other areas. And I always say that what works for somebody in complex illness works for the other groups of people. And in a way, I think that's because complex illness is just a spectrum of all of the things that ail us, but it's just worse. And, when we think about, you know, that, and we were talking about this before we got on the Zoom. When we think about complex illness, we think about mold and Lyme and the co-infections and Epstein-Barr and ME/CFS. And fundamentally, I think there's a lot of people in our society that have had that stuff in the background. And a lot of the times it may have been bad in the past and then it got better, or that may have been really bad in the past, or it may have been kind of mild and in the background and it was bugging them and they may not have even known that they had it. And often what will happen is we see people and they go through sort of a catastrophic stress, either a big gastrointestinal problem that causes leaky gut and stresses out their immune system, or PTSD and trauma, or some other infection or some crazy event that triggers their immune system, and their immune system gets kind of dysregulated and then begins to struggle keeping things that may have been in the background, and all of a sudden that comes to the forefront. And that might be kind of a script of a patient that a lot of us have seen. And what I found is that with COVID is often kind of that trigger that can trigger some of those other things to come to a forefront. And so then that might represent a percentage of long haul COVID is COVID just creates a huge immune stress and then some other things that were in the background come out. That's topic A. But then within like 2 days of when the article came out that there may be a COVID reservoir, i.e. that COVID may continue to live on in the body as an active infection, kind of like herpes or some other infections do, then that may continue to trigger an immune response. And then that may trigger immune stress independent of those other things. And so we probably have a bimodal distribution where sometimes we're looking at a constellation of all kinds of things. And then there may be another version of long COVID that is almost just purely COVID related.
Yeah, no, I like that way of looking at it. Like on one hand, COVID is what unmasked the previous weaknesses that were just often kept in check. And two, you know, though I've been trying to do deep dives, and it's very difficult on whether COVID is really, as they say, replicating or a replicative competent virus chronically, which it might be. Or are we just stuck with a reservoir of proteins? And that's, hopefully we're gonna get the answer to that. You know, I'm hoping that we'll know, but we do know the spike protein hangs around long enough that it can be causing long-term problems for some of the people. And I like the way you broke it down into two, because it doesn't do that for everyone, you know? And so it's a good framework.
But then that framework, I just realized, as I said, maybe we should say three, because maybe the third one category is that COVID virus that is continuing to live in a reservoir. And you told me this, and then I gave a keynote on long COVID, and I had a slide of the picture of the movie Reservoir Dogs that I put, and I said, it's because there's a reservoir where it's hiding out, maybe, for example, in our gut. There's that third category that you brought up is, it may be that COVID is long gone, but there are still little fragments of COVID that are floating around that our immune system is really triggered by, that's creating immune stress. And so then that creates this third category that is not COVID's gone, and maybe there's not even Epstein-Barr or anything else. But then often our journey as diagnosticians is to try to peel the onion and figure out of those three groups what's happening.
Yes, and you know, I said as we've discussed in other parts of the series, there's, you know, and then we have the issue of the microclots and the question of antibodies, which increases some of the need for the therapies that you're quite expert in as well. So I think what we can let people know, and I think this is what's important, is that don't assume when you go to a doctor and they tell you what's causing your long COVID, even if it's somebody who is good at treating this, that they're right. because there are many possibilities here and we kind of have to work through them. And I think that's what's difficult for patients. They're used to the medical model where you do a test and you get a diagnosis and that's what you got. And here we're dealing with what we deal with in chronic complex illness all the time is that you got a bunch of symptoms and we got some tests and then we got to see how you respond. And it's a little bit more of a journey sometimes than people realize.
100%. And so then that microclot example, I think is, a great one because there's of all of the three categories we discussed, then they all lead to a constellation of downstream sort of effects that can affect how blood flows, how in the body, and how our mitochondria are functioning, how much energy we have, how we feel. And so then, I would say it's definitely worth a deep dive in terms of diagnostically thinking about things. But then, we like to try to work on trying some things to just start to make people feel better as well.
Yeah, well, I think that, what I'm realizing, what's fun about having this discussion with you is that we're just like naturally ambling through the thought processes that happen, and first step is often to use what I call Band-Aids, but I love Band-Aids because they stop the bleeding. And if you can get someone to feel a little bit better, a little less stressed, a little more space, improve their sleep, any of the symptoms that we can improve will strengthen the system and perhaps allow a more relaxed and therefore more effective immune response.
That's a good one. And as you think about the diagnostic criteria, we were talking at the beginning that probably many of us are somewhere on the spectrum of some of the things that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Many of us may test positive for Epstein-Barr. Many of us may have had a significant amount of immune stress or some PTSD or some vascular problems that could be complicated by clots. And so then what happens is there's this spectrum, particularly with the immune stuff. And imagine over here, the spectrum is a lot of symptoms, but as you shift to the left, when we have less symptoms. And so then everything that we know of that is good, mindfulness, meditation, sleep, optimal diet, all of those, biohacking, lifestyle, kind of wellness, kind of strategies have the possibility of shifting us to the left. And then often that leads to an optimized immune system. And so optimizing GI health. And so then one, we always think about those things. And when you begin to think about the fact there's going to be tens of millions of people with some amount of long COVID, and you can't forget when you think about the long COVID of the emotional and psychological and psychiatric stuff that goes on, because I can't tell you how many people we've talked to who got depression or anxiety or kind of a fair amount of stress going through the COVID experience and have a hard time coming back.
Yeah, I just had a patient call today, someone I've known for a long time, who's battled with chronic illness for probably 10, 12 years, but functional, done quite well, but just has to be careful. And she just has acute COVID and she's suddenly feeling anxious. Yep. And it's the bug. When the inflammation goes transiently up, people get, it's part of protecting. Anxiety is one of the self-protective responses of the body. It just should be transient. And if it stays stuck, it gets very unpleasant. And but COVID obviously does this. I mean, it has so many neurologic effects that just the infection itself, and then later on the prolonged immune response. So
okay, so then let's start with this one. So what we all know that COVID can go to the brain. It likes to go to the brainstem. So we all know that COVID can go to the brain. It can cause you to lose your smell and taste. We also know, and we know that with COVID-1, a lot of people ended up with PTSD. And that's because one of the limbic system is right there. It's right very close to the brainstem. And what I think happens is if there is inflammation in that part of the brain, then the side effect of inflammation in the limbic system is that we feel anxious and we feel depressed and a whole constellation of emotional symptoms. And so, and to be honest, I got COVID several times and COVID vaccinated, and I got a little bit of that myself. And so then I did what any doctor does is use the tools that you happen to have. And so I did a stellate ganglion block, and it was my favorite treatment that I've ever done for myself. Because what the stellate ganglion block is it's an injection where we put the fight or flight nerves asleep. And the way that we do it now is we treat the fight or flight nerves, and we also treat the vagus nerve. And we put them both asleep. And the idea, I always say, imagine if your body was kind of was assaulted and was kind of ready for a fight, and then the fight or flight nervous system just got turned off, and now you're just like, oh hey Eric, how's it going? and you're just in this kind of total relaxed state, and it breaks kind of the perseverative loop of the fight or flight state. And the other thing that it does is that, but we use ropivacaine, which is a local anesthetic, and it increases blood flow to the brain. And so then one of the things that happens is when you increase blood flow to the brain, one of the first things that the carotid artery does when it goes up into the brain is it goes to the limbic system. So you're sort of resetting the limbic system with increased blood flow. And that can be fairly profoundly helpful. And so we do this for victims of PTSD and trauma, a lot of military, a lot of assault. And but then we have been doing it a lot for people with complex illness, because having complex illness is kind of like being a victim of trauma, because every day you wake up to the same thing that you can't believe is continuing to go on, often for years and years and years. And so then that is a fairly big reboot. We like to do it on both sides. And so we'll do often one on one day and one on the other day. And then we've developed a whole constellation of IV therapy that we do around the stellate. We give vitamin C, we give glutathione. We do a lot of magnesium to basically kind of relax the blood vessels. And that seems to be a fairly helpful part of it. And then we developed this approach. There's a IV phosphatidylcholine that seems to be real good for blood vessel health. And so we started doing that after the stellate. And the interesting thing, the stellate ganglion block will increase blood flow to the brain. And often when you get it, you'll have a little bit of a headache that night. It's a little bit rough to go through. Your eye gets droopy, your pupil gets small, your eye gets red, you can't breathe in one nose. Voice gets hoarse. So it's a little intense of a thing to go through. Once we started doing all these IVs, it was just much smoother. And then the headaches were cut in half. And so then we started doing this. And I would say of everything we've done, it's one of our most effective sort of long COVID treatment strategies, because it represents a fairly powerful emotional reset. And we think of the right side of the body as kind of trauma, left side is cognition. And so a lot of people will tell me, oh, I started to think more clearly after we did the stellate on the left side, my brain fog got a little bit less. Now, it may be that brain fog is from just acidosis and hypercoagulability and decreased blood flow in the brain. And so because of and immune stress and antigenic stress, and so the blood is just flowing a little bit more thick, but it may be that we're having an immune reaction to some of those, that spike protein that's floating around. It may be that our monocytes are active in the blood and they're thick and not moving around. But the stellate has been pretty helpful in terms of a reboot or a reset. That's why I called my company BioReset, was after the stellate. And so then that's been probably my favorite kind of innovative thing that we do for long COVID.
Yeah, it's one of those therapies that, again, is just letting the body find its way back. Mm-hmm. You know, some people consider it invasive, but, again, under ultrasound control, it's a relatively simple, someone who's experienced. I think those two pieces are probably important. And it really is allowing the system to find a new balance point, which is nice.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah. And this was my feeling going through it also, is that when you turn a computer, if we turned our computers off and turned it back on, that's a lot of times if your computer is, if their software is not working, you press Control Alt Delete, or you get to turn that computer off and it comes back on at the factory default settings. And then this has been a lot of our experience. And so then that becomes one of several very interesting sort of approaches, because if we can begin to kind of reboot the mental, emotional, spiritual state, a lot of times then that helps us kind of reset narrative and get people feeling a little bit better and like there's some hope. And so then that has been a pretty transformatively positive experience for us.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really funny, going through this series and talking to many doctors and patient advocates and scientists, but at the end of the day, the need for hope, the need for the alignment of the spirit, to believe that you can get better, mm-hmm. because people just forget that the placebo effect is not an imaginary effect. It is your body's innate ability to heal. And that's what we all need. The drugs are in there just to get us over the hump. Okay. The drugs buy us time. Medicine does its best with trauma, because what we can do with trauma is we can buy you time. We can stop the bleeding. We can put the system back together enough so you have time to do the healing. And it's your own healing that gets you well. And when you do something like the stellate ganglion block or the other things that restore hope and get rid of the script of hopelessness that happens after you've been ill for a while, you really allow for this, I could say it's not magic. I mean, this wondrous place where the body can heal. Sometimes it needs a bit of help, but if you're receptive, you can use the help.
Right. And, I studied meditation with this wonderful Tibetan Lama, Lama Lar, and he in Taos, and he always said, only a terrible doctor wouldn't use the placebo effect. but the other thing that we will use is ketamine. And ketamine is an anesthesia drug that, I use all the time in the operating room. And then, that also can lead to a shift in consciousness and help break some of those perseverative loops. And, but then I think whether you use ketamine or whether you use a stellate ganglion block, or whether you just have an amazing conversation and help to reset the narrative that way. And I would say that's probably my most favorite thing to do, is just try to come to have a little bit of a coaching session of teaching people how to run a narrative that everything is going to be okay. And then I use these techniques often just kind of as training wheels to kind of, a lot of times what happens is you leave some little breadcrumbs in your mind of how you were able to go from kind of a sketchy state into kind of calm. And often that is enough to reboot you back into kind of a where you were before.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I think that, story is our teachers.
Yeah. Yes. And so then, you know, I'm glad we started here, because then that's an important narrative. And then understand that then with that in mind, it's fairly easy to see that how if you reboot your fight or flight status, you might shift over into a place of being kind of in a more mentally, emotionally, spiritually stable place. I think that the immune system works in a similar way. And so as you know, many of the favorite things that we like to use as modalities regulate the immune system. And so they kind of bring a little balance. And then at a high level, kind of as we go into kind of physiology along COVID, one thing that I have found is that in almost no matter how you break it down between those three categories, in all of them, the immune system's fairly stressed out. It's either stressed out because it's fighting a new infection, or it's reacting to some proteins that are sticking around, or maybe it's reacting to a virus that's still there. And if we can bring a little balance to the immune system at large, often that can lead to people feeling quite a bit better. And that begins a little bit of a reset process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I try to remind patients is that it's rarely the virus that makes you really sick. It's your unbalanced immune response. I mean, that's why people die from COVID in the hospital, not from the virus, but from their own immune system. And it's this, I mean, it's one of the things we're going to hopefully explore in some of our sessions, is how the loss of the balance between the T cells and your B cells and their inability to control the innate immune system. And it's the beauty, again, to what you were saying, is that when the mind is doing what it should be doing, then it's going to give the information to that immune system, because the immune system, you know, like I said, I've said this many times in these talks, that we break up the body into systems in order to talk about it, because we can't have a conversation unless we define things. But that's us. Your body doesn't know from immune system. You know, it's just how you flow together. It's a great symphony and dance of energetics. And when the mind is calm, the signal to the immune system is to stand down a little bit. And then the symptoms do get better. And we healing can happen, because when, you know, it's hard to finish the healing journey when the message is still there's a tremendous amount of danger present. It's right. I'm trying to get, one day I want to get Dr. Navio on, because he unfortunately doesn't like to be on video. He gives great lectures, but I'd love to get him on video where he can discuss the nuances of how relaxing the mind and it all goes down to ATP. But that's a whole other world. And I'm sorry, I don't need to go down that rabbit hole. You pressed a button. it's too much deeper.
That's a good one. And we'll kind of I'll circle back to that as we kind of finish. Another thing that's near and so then as we think about that dysregulation, mm-hmm. When we think of dysregulation of the immune system, then you think, is there anything that might regulate the immune system and kind of bring that into balance? And for me, one thing that has been probably the most helpful, just personally and with friends and family and with patients, has been peptides. And so then, you know, there are a host of things that quote unquote regulate the immune system. Stem cells, your own stem cells are floating around, and they help regulate and balance your immune system. You have killer cells is another cell. So we have all of these cells that will regulate. We have cells in our body that will secrete peptides, which are small proteins that can have a regulating effect on the body. We have molecules that we, ozone therapy has a regulating effect on the immune system. And so we have this whole diversity of different things that regulate the immune system. After we calm down the mind with some of the things like we talked about, then you say, okay, what can be done to regulate the immune system? And then how does that do with these sort of three different categories we talked about? And I have found peptides to be fairly helpful broadly. There are, on the peptide front, there's some immune peptides, and they tend to come from your thymus gland. And there are several categories. Thymulin is a new one that's kind of come onto the scene. It's the it's a fragment of thymus and alpha 1, and will have some immune regulating benefits. And we've certainly enjoyed using that because thymus and alpha 1 basically has gone away as a peptide just for regulatory reasons in North America. But thymulin is going to be an interesting one. People will use some of the fragments of thymus and beta 4, especially TB500, which is the 17 to 23 fragment of thymus and beta 4. So those are two interesting ones. Your doctor can work with a compounding pharmacy and then send those to you. And then people will do maybe 500 micrograms, maybe 1 milligram a day. And then sometimes that will be just enough to regulate and kind of harmonize the immune system to some extent. They also can be helpful in terms of fighting infections. And so they'll have immune supportive as well as immune regulating. And so whether somebody's actually dealing with an active infection or an immune system that's just out of control, responding to some particles or peptides that are left over from the an infection. And so then that's been an interesting category. I think you've had some good results with peptides as well.
Yeah, no, we love peptides. I mean, I think it was that's one of the things that I think working with you, we realized how important it was. Dr. Parpia has become enamored of them and just had seen such amazing results when you use them. And I think, and it makes perfect sense because these peptides are breakdown products of the larger proteins that are released initially with injury or with infection. And then as the body is healing, it kind of snips those bigger proteins into pieces. And those are designed to signal us that the battle is over and that we can begin to heal. And sometimes we just need a little bit more of that. The battle is over, we can begin to heal signal. And I think that's what a lot of the peptides are doing. And so I love them. Our patients, more importantly.
Yeah, I know. Our patients do as well. And so then that is as we're moving through, and this is a good one, because as we're moving through diagnostically what's happening, it's useful to be able to do something that's helpful at that time. And, you know, there are some very big, expensive ways to regulate the immune system, stem cells and stuff like that. But peptides are really low cost, easy to do. And then they're a daily intervention that people can do. And so then as a 1.0, a lot of times what we'll try to do is check in, try to diagnostically sort out what's happening. And then often we'll do a couple month course of peptides. Sometimes it's shockingly helpful. Sometimes it's not too helpful at all. And then, you know, we're continuing to work our way through a diagnostic algorithm and sort of figure out what's happening. And then we work on some bigger things. One thing that has been a fairly interesting intervention for us has been plasmapheresis, which is a technique where we run blood through a plasma separator and can pull plasma off of the body. Our blood is about 50% red blood cells and white blood cells and about 50% plasma. So imagine we've got 5 liters of blood on our body, and we got about 2.5 liters of plasma, a little bit more. And so then what we will do is we will pull some of that off, and then kind of like the stellate ganglion block is a reboot of the central nervous system from a blood flow perspective. I think of plasmapheresis as a little bit of a reboot of the vascular immune system, and particularly the immune system that's in the vascular tree, because we're pulling some of that off. We do a version of it where we do a micro dose of ozone. And so we'll do plasmapheresis where we only pull off about a liter or a liter and a half. So it's a smaller plasmapheresis than the traditional therapeutic plasma exchange, but we're able to do it with smaller IVs, and we don't have to put a 17 gauge needle in. And so, you know, but we also do the traditional plasmapheresis, and we've had, I've had some people will be almost night and day in terms of a response after that. And I think part of that is from an ozone is going to be regulating the immune system a little bit. And then a lot of that is just from the effect of plasmapheresis. And then when we do that, we're combining that with vitamin C and glutathione and antioxidants and some quercetin. And so a fairly balanced IV. And so then as a strategy, a lot of times mental, emotional, spiritual, try some peptides. And with that in mind, understand that a lot of times I'm trying to do low cost, simple, most effective, lowest intensity stuff first, and see how that goes. So try some peptides. And I think as we evolve, I think people, you know, at a societal level, that makes a lot of sense, because we don't want to do a $10,000 treatment as our 1.0 for long COVID. I'd like to do some $200 treatments, see how that goes, gather a little bit of data, try to figure out what's going on. And those can be helpful, but then the entire spectrum of IV therapy, and then even remember, just getting a Myers cocktail and some glutathione can be very helpful for some people feeling better, a little antioxidant support. And we'll have some people come in and we'll just do some real simple stuff like that. And I've seen that really shift the needle for some people.
Yeah. Well, there's two things I want to remind people. Number one is that we were talking earlier, and all the therapies that have been talked about in our other episodes, you know, there are things that Dr. Cook explores and does, but I figured we're concentrating today on what I think are more some of the cutting edge things that he and we do that not many other people do, you know, and especially on the stellate ganglion block, which I think is just a brilliant reset that we will send people to Dr. Cook for, and the plasmapheresis, which is, again, is I agree, is an end stage. It's sort of a last step because of the expense of it, but by removing the antibodies, I think it, because this is the great question, is how much of a problem are persistent antibodies? And Dr. Mobeen, Dr. Saeed, people know him as Dr. Bean. He has a podcast. And one of his, he really believes strongly in something that not many people talk about, is that there are anti-idiotype, or basically you make antibodies against the antibodies that you made against the spike protein, which is a little confusing. But anyway, but the fact that these other antibodies that you do to kind of rid your body of the antibodies that you made to protect you, okay, you make antibodies to get rid of them, and those sometimes can bind to the same ACE2 receptors throughout your body and cause problems. And so by getting, and I think that's where probably the plasmapheresis might be a very special, what we're looking forward to is the day, which hopefully will come before the end of 2023, that we actually have testing that can help us identify who has the microclots, you know, who has the persistent spike protein, who has perhaps these particular types of antibodies. I mean, that is the future. Unfortunately, I'm hoping that the government is now spending enough money, and there's enough smart science. There's a lot of really smart scientists out there. I'm going to be talking to some of them who will be able to give us, so doctors like Dr. Cook and I, and we can actually aim the treatments better and be more effective without having to incur costs that are just too much for many people. That's one of the great tragedies of these chronic illnesses.
That's the appealing thing, that if you imagine that I've got half of my blood, you know, this red cells, red blood cells, white blood cells, and the other half is the plasma. All of the antibodies live in that plasma. And so then for certain autoimmune conditions that where there's antibodies and we're really trying, we need to get those antibodies out of the body, we do this thing, this plasmapheresis, where we pull a bunch of plasma off. And when we pull that plasma off, we're pulling antibodies off. Well, if we could pull a bunch of those antibodies off, that kind of clears the deck a little bit. It's kind of like cleaning up the whiteboard. And then now our immune system gets a new take, a fresh take on what's happening. And then often you find, oh, guess what? The war is over. And kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, that's what we're hoping. That's how we hope, you know, how this plasmapheresis is going to make a difference. I mean, it's exciting. I've spoken to a few other doctors. There's not very many people doing it in America for COVID, but I think all of us who are doing it have been impressed by the results.
My favorite experience of my last that I can remember, I got to meet Isaac Elias.
Ah, good. Yes. So that Dr. Elias is doing the help plasma or help apheresis, a slightly different take on it, but.
Slightly different take on it. But so then, you realize we're going to have a diversity of different approaches and strategies and then we'll be again to start to get some data around that of. If you said of all the people that you've talked to, what are the most appealing, what are the top three most appealing treatments that you've heard in your mind for long COVID?
Wow. You know, it's really pretty varied. You know, I think it depends on people's experience because that's why I urge people not to give up, because there is a subset of people who respond to, we have the FLCC camp, which is, you know, the ivermectin and, lowering inflammation, lots of herbs and good things to lower inflammation. And they're beginning to use more of the treating blood clot, you know, microclots. And then you have the microclot group who really think the whole problem is the persistence of the spike protein causing an abnormal form of fibrin, which doesn't get broken down by the, you know, normally. And so you have these persistent microclots, and they feel, you know, so they just, you know, use anticoagulants. And then you have the Dr. Bruce Patterson group who use Maraviroc and statins and platelet stabilizers. So, you know, and so each one of those, as I talk across the groups, they all see their own successes and failures. And what I'm looking to do is to let patients know that don't give up. And this is just like we see with chronic, with the people who have been chronically ill before COVID. You know, some people went to people who are experts in Lyme, and some people went to experts in mold, and some people went to experts in mast cells, and some people went to experts in viral things, and some people went to experts in parasites. And, you know, doctors like you and me and the people we work with realize that it can be all of those, or any of them in different combinations. And that's what I'm trying to get to the world when it comes to treating long COVID. We're in the same ballpark. This is an illness that's about the individual in front of you's biochemistry and genetics. And this is the trigger. The trigger might be the same, but we're shooting in one person a 22. I mean, I hate these violent things, but anyway, you know, we're very different responses depending on the person. And that's what makes it hard for the patient until we get really good testing, because then they're stuck having to like hope that they say the right words to us that we can prioritize their treatment, you know?
I love that. And you know, all of those modalities I would be supportive of. And then I've seen people get all of those modalities and do well.
Yeah, exactly. Because they all work sometimes.
They all work sometimes. And so then they're all, and this is a, if you said, you know, if you had this, the simplest problem in the world is going to have a relatively simple solution. This is not the simplest problem in the world. This, it's multifactorial. And so then it may be that there's a person with microclots that needs something that is going to help in clotting. Now that could be, you know, they could take nattokinase, they could take Belux, they could take an antiplatelet medication, they could take aspirin. I could say 15 other things, lumbokinase. Right. So then all of those things are going to be helpful. It turns out ozone will, when you give ozone, you give heparin, and so you get that benefit. But ozone also improves viscosity and improves blood flow in blood vessels. And so then all of those things, and so then you get this huge diversity of things just on a, let's say, a microclot perspective. And then yet, if there's something else going on and then we don't address that, that person might take all of those things and then they may not get better. And then we think, oh, the microclot medication that I took didn't work. It may work. It just may be that we missed something else diagnostically that was going on. That's why we started out with the diagnostic. And it's humbling as we think about it, because I feel like together, really, there's nobody that we haven't talked to in terms of like, at least like Bruce Patterson, I think the world of him, everybody in this conversation, I think, is doing a great job. And it's a nuanced thing, but in my mind, again and again and again, I come back to multimodal therapy.
Absolutely, Matt. It's, and you know, as we're talking, what really upsets me is that there are relatively so few of us out there, and people are going to the centers of excellence for long COVID. And basically, you know, they're being given excellent medical care, but they're not being treated. You know, they're being given, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy once again. Their autonomic stuff is being treated because finally, you know, enough cardiologists are aware of, you know, autonomic dysfunction and actually recognize it and treat it. But that's about it.
Okay, I got a good one. And so then you taught me this, and this was like this, and I always quoted you on this. And so it's a great, because you know, when I'm a young anesthesiologist that doesn't know too much, and I'm out here doing this stuff. And then you taught me about POTS, which is postural orthostatic hypotension, which is if I stand up, I'm going to squeeze my blood vessels a little bit to maintain blood flow to my brain so that I have kind of steady blood flow. We all do this all the time. And so this is our autonomic or automatic nervous system that does that. And then what you taught me a long time ago was, if somebody has that, they probably either have mold or Lyme. And then I have never seen anybody that has a significant case of POTS that doesn't have some kind of infection, co-infection, could be Epstein-Barr, could be mold or Lyme, something in that spectrum. Now we're really seeing a lot of people with long COVID present with that. And then also present with mast cell activation. I remember when we were at the lecture when they first introduced mast cell activation, like 5 or 6 years ago. So then you say, as now to go a little bit deeper, well, let's say somebody has that. What are some modalities that we can use to treat that? Because those are like actual symptoms that can drive people crazy. And interestingly, when you have that POTS, a lot of times you'll stand up and get dizzy, but then a lot of times you can get a little bit of a tachycardia. So your heart rate will go up as a response. And then often people can get panic attacks, and often people can get some emotional stuff that come up just as a physiological response to having your heart rate go to 120. So then one thing that I have found, and we found this for a long time, is that this vitamin NAD, which is a derivative of vitamin B3, and has some mitochondrial benefits, and it's basically, it's like a little battery, or it's like currency in the body, and it can donate an electron and facilitate a high energy reaction. And it can do that in your Krebs cycle that makes energy in your cells. It can do it in detox pathways. We've seen that that can be fairly helpful. And so it used to be that somebody would listen to a talk like this and they would say, well, how do you get it? And you say, oh, well, you're going to go and they're going to put an IV in and then they're going to drip it in over 8 hours. And that was kind of in the addiction world. Now we get NAD from a compounding pharmacy, and then we put some fluid in the bottle, and then we mix it up, and then we draw up an insulin syringe, and then people can give themselves NAD subcutaneously. That can, it has some immune stimulating benefits, and then it also has some mitochondrial benefits. And I would say it's probably been my one of my better supportive things that I give people with POTS that will help them get better. I got to be careful, and you taught me this also, start low, give them real low dosing. And so then instead of giving like 500 milligrams in an IV, we give 100 milligrams slowly. Instead of giving 100 milligrams in a shot, we'll start at like 10 or 20 and kind of slowly work our way up. That has been a real helpful modality. For us, have you found NAD to be helpful in the long COVID world?
I really haven't used it a lot in the long COVID world. You know, and NAD is something that we go in and out of. It's just something about my patient population is that I don't get the response, because I know almost everyone I talk to gets like your experience, phenomenal responses to NAD. And I think God is just playing with me. You know, as I always say, you know, like some things just work for you, but I just like the idea. But the NAD sub Q at the low doses, I think is a great thing, because it's a way for people to find out inexpensively if it's going to move the needle for them. You know?
And the thing is that NAD has this huge diversity. It turns on, it can help with DNA repair. It can help with detox. It can help with some immune stimulation. It has these mitochondrial benefits. What I learned from you early on is in that narrow subset of people with relatively catastrophic complex illness, in that population, if you give them 100 or 200 milligrams, it can really overwhelm them. And I think it may be that it triggers detox pathways in that population that become a little bit overwhelming. And whereas somebody that basically has a much more mild case, they don't have too much detox going on, then they can take a relatively big dose of NAD and it doesn't bug them. So then that's where the low cost NAD and then these real micro dosing. And so I started, basically we mix it up so that 50 units in an insulin syringe is 100 milligrams. And so then we make it so we give people a 10 milligram dose. It's like this real baby dose. And then they kind of get used to that and then they work their way up.
And yeah, that's I love it. But we probably have to wrap up. We can talk all night. and keep, because there's no, I mean, this is what the fun thing of sharing, and that's what, that's what, you know, medicine used to be like, of sharing ideas. Because what people have to understand is that the things we're talking about are safe, in the sense that, you know, low dose NAD isn't going to, the worst it'll do is cause some transient nausea. You know, it's not going to hurt anyone. And that's what medicine has devolved, is that because so many of the pharmaceuticals that can be used will actually have, you know, significant negative effects if they're used in the wrong person. We've made a very high bar to trying things. And that's why those long COVID centers aren't doing much, because they're waiting for the, you know, $5 to $100 million study to show that X actually does more harm than good. While we can't do that, because it takes too many years, and especially for things that cannot be patented, then nobody's going to do those studies. So using microdoses of NAD are not going to be studied, you know, ever. So we have to share amongst ourselves and learn from each other, and then go out there and offer these opportunities to people. And I just hope that, you know, the powers that be realize there's a difference between giving harmful substances in large quantities and using micro doses of nutrients. So on that somewhat paranoid and hopeful note, because, you know, I mean, it's just, we've both been doing this long enough, and we just see that so many people do get well, and mm-hmm. we have to keep getting out there and being able to offer these things to allow that, and not be consigned to the, you know, Prozac and come back in 6 months when you're not any better, and I'll change the antidepressant.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, even those, a lot of those COVID clinics, they're finding, you know, some good, I've read some great articles. So they're finding, you know, just a lot of brick and mortar normal stuff, because people haven't been going to the doctor either. And so they're finding a lot of stuff that is not COVID. And, but then I think that as we go, what's going to happen is we are going to build a vocabulary of products, from micronutrients to supplements to regenerative medicine to injections that reset to drugs, ketamine, and that we're going to have a vocabulary of how to regulate the central nervous system, the immune system, and then the gut. And then as we do that, we will bring balance to the body. And as that happens, then people will most likely begin to feel better, and then be helped. Their body will begin to regulate itself.
Yeah, I on that note, I just fully, yeah, that's the prayer, and that's what we see when it works, and we're going to keep doing it.
Yeah, and so getting better. Thank you,
Matt. Thank you. Thank you. And everyone, they know where to find you. It's Dr. Matt Cook at BioReset.
BioReset.com.
Okay.